Welcome to Still Not Asking For It, a podcast brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center. I am your host, Elena, and today I am with Mel G, our producer, and Hope Harbor volunteer and a great friend of mine, Kaylee, who is here to kind of talk about sex subcultures and kind of expand on some of the conversations that were started in one of our previous episodes when we were talking about BDSM. So Kaylee, thank you so much for being here. And why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
So my name is Kaylee. And like Elena said, I am a volunteer with Hope Harbor. Been doing that now for about 3 years. And I absolutely thoroughly enjoy it. It's definitely a mission I'm incredibly passionate about because it is such a personal mission as being a survivor myself. I am a childhood sexual survivor, also a survivor of adulthood sexual assault as well. I'm actually currently even battling one of my perpetrators in court still. And I am, as far as identities go, I grew up as I got into like my late teen, you know, like early teens when Tumblr and MySpace was a whole thing and I really got to discover myself. I pretty much knew before the internet raised me that I was somebody into all genders. And then I was introduced to the term bisexual, which I mostly have identified with in my life just because that was really the only term that I knew. And as time has gone on, you know, I think if I'm giving a short answer to somebody that asks me, I say bisexual. But if I have time and I want to kind of explain it to them, you know, I don't really identify necessarily with a label, but probably closest would be pansexual. And on top of, I guess, identities to discuss, I also am poly. I'm not currently in a poly relationship, but in my past, I've been in numerous polyamorous relationships.
So what is poly, or what is polyamorous? Or what does it mean for you?
So polyamorous to me means having more than one emotional or sexual partner. You know, for different people, it means different things. But for me personally, when I am with someone, I'm typically in it for the emotional and the sexual side. And so that's mostly what it means to me. It's that I'm with more than one person at the time in a connected basis.
And then so in polyamorous relationships, is it like a throuple? Where like three people are all in it together?
It can be. So I've been in a relationship that was a throuple, where I was dating a couple that was previously together before they met me. So previously I was married for a few years. I was with my ex-husband all total around 7 years. And so I have been in a scenario where it is a throuple, where I was dating a couple that was together before I met them. But with my ex-husband, we were on what most people would probably call an open relationship, but it's, to me, it's still polyamorous. My husband had partners and I had partners, but our partners did not participate together.
Because that's been something that, and which I think too, right? It's different for everybody, but knowing the difference, I guess, between like open relationship and poly, but maybe that's not even that important.
Yeah. I mean, the thing about talking about this is it's really hard because it's so personal to the person and the relationships. Everybody has their own boundaries. Everybody has their own wants and desires and their apprehensions to it. And so, you know, I've met people who have truly what I would classify as open. They can do literally whatever they want. They don't have to clear it by their partner. They just have complete and total trust that that partner is, you know, abiding by, you know, whatever ground rules they have. And honestly, in that relationship that I've, you know, been close to as far as like friends with them, they just didn't have any rules for the most part. There just wasn't any. It was just be safe, really. Like, whatever you do, just be safe. But then I've also been friends with and have had relations with couples who want to bring a third in, but it's very limited on the things that they want to do. And that's more typically, I've seen that more with like couples who are brand new to the idea, who like want to kind of dabble in it, but don't want to just dive straight into the whole thing. But it's really hard. It's hard to answer that because it means something different to everybody.
So you're talking about like, yeah, when people want to invite somebody in, are those typically, and maybe in your experience, like straight couples or straight passing couples,
mm-hmm,
who are, yes, looking for a bi, mm-hmm, woman.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that's like the stigma that can be really frustrating, because that's happened to me several times when I do disclose that I'm bisexual. There's this whole stigma that it's, oh, well, then your perfect scenario is one man, one woman. And it's not the case. And it was especially frustrating when dating, online, when I had to do online dating for a while, it was just assumed that like, oh, well, you're a single woman that lists that they're bisexual and poly, then you must want to be strictly with one man and one woman.
Which is then where like the idea of like a unicorn.
Yeah, the whole concept of a unicorn. Yeah, unicorn is a woman that is like this idealistic woman that comes in and feeds the desires of the male and the woman in the relationship.
Do you like that term?
I don't like it or dislike it. I mostly think I don't care because I don't identify with it.
Okay, the concept of that to me seems very sexist.
Mm-hmm.
One, that it's, yeah, a woman. Right. And so it has to be the woman, and like, God forbid, it's, mm-hmm, like a bisexual man coming in.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But also the comment, like, it's just, I don't know. It's so objectifying, like this, which like is an issue in general for people that are bisexual or pansexual, that like they're, mm-hmm, this sexual object that should be used.
Yeah.
But I guess, I mean, that's also goes into like the sexualization of like lesbian or bisexual women in general is like where that.
Right. So, I mean, even if you haven't really heard much about polyamory or you haven't had much exposure to it, I can't imagine that you haven't been exposed to the concept of a threesome with two women and a man. Like almost everybody has heard of that or been exposed to that. But what is almost never talked about or exposed to, which is actually my preferred throuple scenario, is two men and one woman. So two bisexual men. But you just never hear about it because it's very taboo. It's very taboo for men to be bisexual, in my opinion. It's very taboo for men to be bisexual. For women, it's like the whole stereotype of like, oh, it's so hot. That's so acceptable, right? Because women in some ways are allowed to explore that side of their sexuality because it's in some ways accepted in mainstream society. But for men, not as much.
I would say that it's acceptable because only if benefiting men, right? Yeah,
only if benefiting men.
So it's only hot, right? If, mm-hmm, men get to watch it.
Right.
You know, if it's benefiting men in some way, although like gay men definitely benefit from each other. So it's like, right. It's not something that logically makes sense.
Right. No,
it doesn't logically make sense.
No.
And this is when I think porn, you know, I am, in which I feel like I definitely talked about this in the BDSM episode. Like I am not against porn at all, mm-hmm, but there are issues, right, with, the way that people, like with that being the only exposure that people have to certain things and to certain conversations about sex, mm-hmm, because we live in a culture where we do not want to talk about it. And honestly, that is something we experience working at a rape crisis center, right? Where we help people who have been hurt, right, in this way, mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. that we still see that these are taboo topics. These are taboo conversations that make people uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's, yeah, sex in general.
Yeah.
Fine. That's what I'd like for our podcast to be helpful in normalizing.
Mm-hmm. Normalizing
the word
it,
yeah. Sex.
Mm-hmm.
You say sex and penis and vagina.
One of the things I found interesting is, and this is something that I had talked about with friends that identify themselves as women, but like, I feel like most men that are in relationships with women think that like women are so into them and like, oh, my penis and all of this. And like, if you were to poll women, and I read an article where they did poll this, the high majority of women are watching lesbian porn. Mm-hmm. They are not watching porn with a man in it.
Mm-hmm.
And it just kills me, because even women that identify as straight and have never had a sexual relationship with a woman are watching female on female porn.
Mm-hmm.
I feel like that would be such a blow to so many guys. No, probably mm-hmm. wouldn't. They probably wouldn't be offended about it at all. They would probably think mm-hmm. it's like for them. Like, let me watch you watch women.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay. So what are, so when talking about poly relationships or open relationships, what are the benefits of that? Like, what would make you, or like, what were the benefits for you? What interest you into having that conversation with your partners? Mm-hmm.
So for me, it's hard to be, I won't say hard. I love femininity and masculinity of all levels. So like uber masculine, uber feminine, like to me, there's not really a preference, but I like to engage in that. And I like to have both sides of that to me and exploring my femininity and my masculinity. And so for me, I get so much fulfillment out of being able to explore that with both sides, the femininity and the masculinity. But to me, it's on a scale, right? There's not just feminine and masculine, right? There's ebbs and flows to it. And so when you are in a single partner relationship, it can make it difficult to explore both sides. And it's not obviously that person's fault, right? Because they are who they are. So finding somebody for your single person relationship that can help you explore both sides can be very limiting. Now, I'm very fortunate because that's what I'm in right now. But, and why my just single person relationship is very successful is because that is the case. But previously, in my previous relationships, I wasn't able to do that in my like my straight passing relationships. Like my marriage was straight passing, but my ex-husband was bisexual as well. You know, he had needs and wants and desires that were very opposite from mine. And so for a while, that was really what helped us get closer, was the fact that we were both able to meet those needs and desires in a healthy fashion, where we both were sharing those experiences together. Now, I didn't enter my first poly relationship where I was single, technically single, and reaching out and being a part of someone else's relationship initially, until I was in my late 20s. I was in a relationship in my young 20s with a couple. It didn't last very long, but just like a few months. So I don't know. I feel like the benefits of it for me are like, I get to explore all sides of who I am emotionally and sexually.
How did those conversations kind of start with your partners of like, hey, this is what I'm into, or hey, I heard about so-and-so was doing this. What do you think about it? Like, what was like what started that?
Mm-hmm. So for me, my ex-husband came out to me as bisexual. You know, he knew I was bisexual going into it. And I'm just going to use bisexual because it's just easier, right? To just throw a label onto it. The more conversations we had about it, you know, I had told him, I said, you know, I went into it with him knowing my past of being in open relationships, being poly, being bisexual. So he was aware of all of that. And I feel like eventually that's why he felt comfortable coming out to me and telling me. And he came out to me before we were ever married. You know, I broached it and was like, you know, if there are things that you're missing, like he would tell me things that he would want to do and the things that he was missing, because he previously had male partners before. You know, I told him, I was like, I'm okay with that. You know, I'm okay with you exploring and, you know, us having ground rules and, you know, doing that together as a partnership and experiencing that. And so I initially brought it up because of my previous experiences. My first experience with it, I was approached by a bisexual couple and was asked to participate. And before that, I mean, I had read about it on the internet, right? Like I was exposed to it. I mean, we all grew up on Tumblr. So it was like, I knew about all these concepts before. But that was really how it came up in my previous marriage, was I was the one that sort of broached that subject to try to help my partner find and explore that side of himself.
Yeah, I think that there is such apprehension, right? Like to share that information with your partner, which is almost implying, right? Like I'm not satisfied with you, and that can sound hurt. Like that can hurt, right? Because we live in a very serial monogamous society, where having multiple partners seems bad. It seems deviant. I don't like that word. I use it intentionally to point out that it's, I think, incorrect. I mean, there's this misunderstanding about it. There's this taboo, right? About even being able to say, I love you and I want to be with you. But also, but if we're talking about what I'm into sexually, you don't satisfy all of that.
Yeah. And it definitely can be emotionally very exhausting. I'm not so much anymore, just because I've done this for several years. I mean, I've considered myself poly for over 10 years now, but you are so pressured by society. You know, if your partner comes to you and says, hey, I love you, but I also am into men and I want to emotionally and sexually pursue a man, you know, that can be something that's hard to swallow because of what you've been conditioned in society. I think that I would have struggled with it more if I hadn't first experienced it by coming into a couple and almost being taught, right? Like the proper way to be poly. I feel very fortunate because I feel like if I was like many other poly couples that I have known who like think that they have this great idea of like what, how awesome it'll be and just jump headfirst and like don't have deep emotional discussions and talk about it a ton before they ever even get into it, typically fail at being successful at it and being able to continue the relationship. So I feel like I was very fortunate in that respect. But it can be really hard. I feel like if anyone tells you, oh, I've never been jealous in a relationship, they're just, I don't believe them. I genuinely just don't. Maybe that's wrong, but I'm just like, there's no way. You're human. Every human is going to have, you know, those emotions, especially in the societal world that we live in the US.
Right. And I think too, like maybe just different levels of jealousy. Like some people some jealousy is like debilitating, like you can't get over it. And the other ones are like, oh, I had a ping. I thought about it, you know, but we were able to talk about it. And that's like what is so important in these types of, in poly and open relationships, right? Is that open conversation. That,
communication.
Yeah. And that trust, and that's what I think like a way that I would like to connect, you know, these episodes that we're having on the podcast about BDSM, right? Which is consent culture, right? Like you have to know what you're agreeing to.
Very consent culture.
Yeah. And I see the parallels between that and polyamorous relationships, open relationations, which is so, I don't want to say it's absent, but it is not ingrained in mainstream and like monogamous relationships.
No, it's not. It's interesting because my, you know, monogamous straight passing relationships that it isn't even really discussed as much, but in my relationships that might even dabble into BDSM or, you know, have been poly are very much about over-communicating, talking about everything, making sure you're comfortable every step of the way. And it's so ingrained into that culture. It's interesting because it's not in our mainstream, you know, heterosexual, cis relationships.
And I find that like to be, I don't know, an interesting viewpoint, right? Or outlook on like polyamorous open relationships being an option for couples when maybe they would have broken up. Right. So like, right. If everyone was empowered, and I know this wouldn't work for everybody, so maybe I shouldn't say everyone, for folks who were exposed to this option to be like, this happens, people do this and it works, that it would actually keep relationships together, you know, that like, instead of right, sneaking around, lying, you know, talking with like having right, these, what we would call like extramarital, you know, affairs, right. Instead of just being honest and saying, hey, so I'm kind of into X, Y, and Z. Are you into that? No, I'm not. Or they can't be into it, right? Because it has to do with bodies or something like that. To being like, okay, what do you think about this idea? Right. And if that was normalized, if that was to be able to have, like, I just wonder how many relationships would actually stay to, you know, like stay together, which I know is not always the point for everybody.
Well, I was going to say, I think the biggest issue with this is we have such a patriarchal view of what a relationship is and then of what sex is. So in media, like I can't think of any time in a movie, in a show, in a documentary even, like that we're really shown either a successful open poly relationship or even like a poly relationship is like a throuple. Is that an okay term to use?
Yeah. Okay. That's okay.
I feel like what we do see though is polygamy, which is, and I think that's something that I at least want to make a big distinction of, because even though we know those differences, I feel like a lot of times when people hear the term polyamorous, I feel like because of what they see in the media, they're going to make these assumptions. Just like when we had our episode about trans issues, it's, you know, the most people that see a trans person, they're only seeing what they see in the media. And I feel like that may be an issue with this as well, is people are seeing, I don't know, what's the weird show that was on TLC that was like the creepy man that had like 17 wives?
Sister wives or...
Yeah, whatever.
Yeah, and... well, it's like, it's almost like an equivalent to like freak shows kind of, right? They're like sensationalized and they're fetishized as well. And they're put out as like this like outskirt of society when it... You know more polyamorous people than you really know, right? There are there are a ton more polyamorous people that you have no idea that are in your life, because it is such a taboo thing that people don't typically bring it up. And until somehow that gets broached, you don't know. But, you know, we only see it in society in, like you said, like Sister Wives and like other shows that sensationalize, you know, what they have, or are finding like super niche scenarios to then, you know, exploit almost what it is. And then that's what people jump to. And when I've told people before, they've said like, oh, so like you're with one guy and like multiple women. And I'm like, absolutely not. Like maybe, but it's not that setup. Like he's not like our ruler and we all like, you know, are beneath him. Like, no.
I wanted to bring up, so thruple is totally because of, like, for me, why I said thruple is because of Schitt's Creek. Yeah. I've heard thruple before. But talking about, yeah, not having, yeah, that was not a successful thruple relationship, unfortunately.
No. And I think that's a good point, because it's not all sunshine and rainbows. Like, just like with your cis heterosexual relationships, you know, you, what is it like the statistic, like 50% of cis heterosexual marriages end in divorce, right? Like every relationship and subcultures that are applied to those have their pros and cons and their successes and their failures. And I've been an unsuccessful, I mean, you've heard me say it, my ex-husband, right? So my marriage failed, and not because we were poly, but because my ex, there's a lot of reasons that we don't even have to get into, but one of the biggest reasons was lying. So in a polyamorous relationship, you know, trust is important, and trust is important in every relationship. I don't care what you do, what you identify as, what your sexual preferences are. Trust has to exist in that relationship. And trust was broken multiple times in our polyamorous relationship. And, you know, it stemmed into a ton of other things that were outside of our sexual world. But, you know, polyamorous relationships aren't always successful.
Yeah, it's like with any, right, like not, like in anything that's not the norm, you know, we see this with marginalized identities, right? Like you, people hold on to the negative. If they already have this negative attitude mm-hmm. or belief about something, then it's like, oh, here's an example of why that didn't work and why it never works for people. Mm-hmm. Instead of, right, yeah, like, you know, the whole sanctity of marriage argument also makes no sense, really, but yeah. I bet it's actually higher than 50% now. I feel like growing up, yeah. It was like 50, but I bet it's higher, which I do think there's a lot of contributors to that. And part of it is normalizing getting out of abusive relationships.
Very much so.
I was curious to ask about, you know, so you've already shared that you're a survivor. Mm-hmm. And maybe talking about how being a survivor maybe has affected your relationship with sex, maybe not now, but like mm-hmm. kind mm-hmm. of like as a journey.
Yeah. So I was, my first assault started when I was 10. So I was very young. I hadn't even gone through puberty yet. Right. And so when, assaults happen to children, that can also affect physically and psychologically their maturity and their puberty path. And it did for me, for sure. I was introduced to sex very early on, was a participant in sexual acts. And so I started having consensual sexual, acts when I was like 13, which is, it's really young, right? Like most people might have their kiss, right? Their first kiss or whatever. But I associated sexual acts with love. So I filled my voids with sexual activities. Yeah. So for me, in a young age, I was so confused as to what I was even doing, what it meant, what was safe, what was not. I just didn't know. I wasn't taught. And so everything I was taught, I learned through abuse. So I had a very warped sense of what it meant. When I was young, I, you know, not only struggled with the abuse from my sexual abuser, but I had a very rough home life as well. So I kind of had it from like all angles. So I just really just grew up with this really warped sense of what love meant. So in the beginning, I sought approval from men for other various reasons, not just from my sexual abuse. So for me, it was a way to build self-confidence, to feel good about myself. It was all I knew is like to feel good, that's what you did. And as I started to understand the gravity of my situation when I got into my mid-teens and I started to understand kind of what I had been through, a lot of the trauma started to affect my intimacy. I didn't want to be intimate with men. I didn't want really, honestly, anything to do with men. And it wasn't, I hate the whole stereotype of like, oh, a woman experiences sexual assault and then she just swears off men. It's like, no, it's not at all what happened to me. I've loved women since I was little. Like, oh my, I have been bisexual, pansexual, whatever, since birth. Like I can think of things that I did as a child where I was like, how did no one know? that's when I really started to explore my sexuality with women. And I was in several relationships in high school with women and in my, you know, early teens, late teens with women. And then when I was in my very early 20s, is when I had my first experience with a couple. And that's really kind of what helped me sort of get back to dating men. And then I had two serious, straight passing relationships with men. After my divorce is when I started to explore again the polyamorous side more. You know, I explored it with my ex-husband, which was my last serious relationship, and then I continued to explore that path.
So I'm curious, I guess, what are for you, like, what was the, like, I want to say empowerment, but I don't want to like give you that label. Mm-hmm. But you talked about like being with a couple in your 20s that kind of brought you back to being interested, right? Being with men again. Because I think that's like really what I would love to share with others, right? Is how these, you know, subcultures, these identities and these communities that are usually hidden from, you know, main society, who are often, you know, stereotypes, these negative labels, how they're actually beneficial on mm-hmm. an individual level, at least to mm-hmm. survivors.
Mm-hmm. So for me, it was my first experience with a loving sexual relationship where it was more than just giving myself sexually to serve a man. It was really my first healthy experience of, you know, two very emotionally mature individuals who, you know, it's not like they set out to do this for me, to help me in this healing process. That wasn't their goal, right? But just by them being caring and loving and nurturing and being how you should be in a healthy relationship, it helped me see what it can be and really what it should be. And it sort of set a little bit of a standard for me in a way that I didn't fully come to realize until a few years ago, probably. But it helped me realize like, oh, I can have a sexual relationship with a man that cares about my wants and needs, that is emotionally open to me, that is, you know, more than just please me and then we move on. It was lovely. It was a very empowering. And being a single poly person is very empowering for me. And almost taking back ownership of myself, my own wants, my own desires. And that was very instrumental in my healing process, especially having a bad experience in a poly relationship.
Was there an element of having to overcome shame? Whether it be shame of the abuse, of wanting sex, mm-hmm. And then maybe the shame of, right, being in what people may call a deviant or like a subculture, right? Of, mm-hmm. I mean, maybe even being bi, you know, mm-hmm. as well.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, even today, even though I don't care, like, who in my life knows, it's also one of those things where I still, like, will I be judged? What are they going to think? Like, it's still in the back of your mind. Like, not once did I have that thought when I'm in a heterosexual straight passing relationship, right? Not once is that even a thought in my mind of like, oh, what are people going to think when I walk into this movie? Or what are people going to think when I sit down at the dinner table? Like not a single time has that ever come to my brain until I'm in a polyamorous relationship. And I've only been in one that we openly went out together and like openly weren't hiding necessarily what our relationship dynamic was, like when we would go out on dates and things. But there's a lot of shame with it. And there was a huge transitionary period. So for me, I had this very long transformative journey when it came to shame and owning my own sexuality and feeling like it was okay to want to do the things that had been used against me as abuse. And that took a long time because, you know, originally when I was being abused, I was a young child. I didn't know it was wrong. I felt like it was wrong. I didn't like it. I was uncomfortable. But then the way that it was handled once it came to light was the very typical Southern cultural response of, they didn't mean it. It's not a big deal. You're fine though, right? You know, and we hollered it under the rug because you can't let the church find out, you know, things like that, like the typical response. So for me, it was once I was brought to light and the abuse was stopped, when there was an intervention, it was, this was really wrong. It shouldn't have happened, but also it was okay. It was all mixed signals, right? It was wrong, but also it wasn't that bad. It made no sense to me as a child, obviously. And so for a long time, there was this shame of, then when I started to mature and grow sexually, was, oh, is it okay that I want to do the things that I was forced to do in an abusive scenario? That took a long time to really be okay with it. And it probably wasn't until mid-20s that I really haven't struggled with that. I honestly haven't struggled with it in a long time.
I really appreciate you being honest about that, being vulnerable about that, because I do think that is something that a lot of survivors would not know how to, I think, maybe even articulate, right? Like, and I think too, it is so important that, and I totally get, right? Some people aren't into sex, right? I understand the asexual, you know, identity and all of, and everything that falls under that, you know, but I do think that if it's taken from you, right, you didn't have that choice. That's something that should be addressed, right? That you should have the opportunity to gain that power back. I appreciated you you saying that too, about you were able to take ownership of what you wanted, what you liked, and had a say in it. And even for people who aren't survivors, that's not always the level of empowerment that is achieved.
Yeah. Yeah. And I feel like I was very fortunate in some of the partners that I had, because up until I was with an incredibly emotionally mature, healthy, in a couple individuals, I don't know that I would have been able to even achieve that within my 20s. Like, I feel like it would have been something that would have taken a lot longer for me to do. I mean, obviously the last 5 years or so, I've been very consistent with therapy, which has been, you know, obviously a huge game changer when it comes to healing from my traumas. But, you know, a lot of people aren't afforded that opportunity or even to even know that it's okay.
I was going to, yeah, ask too about like therapy's role in this journey, right? Whether it be, you know, as a survivor or as a survivor who is also poly, you know, who's also, had these open relationships, like, the benefit, right? But I also appreciate you pointing out too, not everybody has the financial option.
The financial option, you know, people, I didn't have anyone in my immediate family or in my family at all, whether it be immediate or not. No one in my family was healthy enough or mature enough to know what to do and to how to help me heal and how to take care of me. And so if I had stayed in that predicament, I may have never known, right? And there's a lot of people who don't, which is why it's very important to always point out red flags when you see it to people, because my journey of healing started by people pointing out red flags to me.
So since you discussed therapy, do you feel like your therapist or therapists that you have had have been receptive about you being poly? Because just from other conversations that Elena and I have had on and off the podcast, like, these are things that we're trying to figure out, like, is the mental health community up on these types of things? Like, are they, are they open? And do you feel like you've been supported when you discuss those type of things in your lifestyle?
My first therapist, not so much, not initially. My very first therapist years and years ago did not really understand it. They felt like it was going to hinder my healing. It took a little while to realize, like, this isn't the right therapist for me.
Can I pause? Can I interrupt you? Mm-hmm. Did they share their basis of why they thought it wasn't going to be helpful to your healing?
So they were very focused on my relationship with men. And initially they told me that I only wanted to explore women as a way to act out.
Oh my gosh. Like hearing you though, say that, like repeat what your therapist had said about you. That is the problem. Right. And I have a similar story of being with a therapist who was very clearly anti-gay, right? At this point, right? It was not obvious, you know, when I, you know, my first sessions and I was younger, I was a teenager. And then a statement like that comes out, right? And you're like, oh, okay. So now I know how you really feel. Yeah.
That was my experience of my very first therapist basically telling me, we really need to focus on your relationship with men. And I really think that you're drawn to women because of your past experiences with men, and things can be really great with men. Spoiler alert, they were a man. And they basically said that I was only having these desires with women because of it. And I said, well, that doesn't make any sense to me because I've liked women sexually since I can remember, right? Like I've been drawn to women since I was a child. It's like the same question you pose to a heterosexual individual, you know, when did you know you were straight, right? It's just an innate part of who you are. And so thank goodness I had the internet because I don't know that I would have even identified that this therapist was very incorrect. If I didn't have the internet, kind of telling me like, hey, that you're okay to be the way that you are. And my sexual abuse did not affect my sexual preference in any way. It had zero effect on that. My first one, not so much. Then I didn't go with therapy for a while. And then I started with a trauma therapist about 6 years ago now. And she was incredible. She kind of changed my entire mind about what therapy meant. I went to her for a little bit. She was very supportive. And actually I did joint counseling with my ex-husband for a while. And at that point we were open about our poly relationship as well. And they were both his therapist and my therapist. Then we would do joint therapy. We're very open to it and fine with it. And then my current therapist, who is absolutely phenomenal. She's incredible. She has changed my life. She is 100% okay with it and understands the nuances with it. And even understands how it can be a really great tool to my healing as well and empowerment and ownership of my sexuality.
That is such a great story though, I think, to hear, right? Of coming back to therapy. I've heard stories, especially with people who are LGBTQ, you sharing this with a therapist and then you're like, I don't want to try that again. Right. Because like going to therapy is a lot of work.
It's a lot of work.
It's not usually preventative, right? It's okay. Things have gotten really bad. I have to do reactive. This now. So to hear that you were able to, or maybe you had to, right. You had to get over the disappointment and put mm-hmm. yourself back out there again. Mm-hmm. Because I think for some people, they don't do that, but I do think it's important people hear that because mm-hmm. I think there is, I don't know, like a lot of excuses that can be made for mental health professionals who, and service providers like ours, right. Of, oh, they didn't mean that. Oh, well, you know, and it's like, no, but you can cause like real harm.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, like I would argue, honestly, that is a form of conversion therapy.
Oh, it is. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, he was very much of the mindset that I only wanted to be with women because I had had this great adversity to men because of my experience with my first perpetrator being a man. And, you know, even when I tried to explain it, you know, he would try to flip it on me of like, yeah, but it's just because of X, Y, and Z that you're this way. And I'm like, dude, I was humping Barbies when I was like six, like before everything, like anything ever happened. Like, you can't tell me I don't like women. Like, I know that I have. But again, I don't know that I would have known that if I didn't have the internet, which allows you to connect with people who are like you and can validate you.
I think it is so interesting how people differentiate between reasons why bi women and bi men are bisexual. Like, I've heard so many times, like, women that identify as bi are this way because either a man has done something to them or they haven't found the right man or something along those lines. Oh, yeah. And then with men, it's like, well, a bisexual man's gay and just hasn't made that decision. Like, I've heard that a lot. And it's always under these terms of like, well, they have to like men, obviously, is kind of what it comes back to. Like, more straight, or obviously this man is more gay, as if it's like men would be the chosen sexual partner. Mm-hmm. And like, how dare they not want to choose that? And I think it's fascinating how like just bisexuality in general is just pushed aside as a,
mm-hmm.
I don't know how I'm trying to finish that.
And just invalidating.
They just invalidating and justifying.
Yeah.
You have to feel like you have to justify it. You know, I feel like we are thankfully at a point where for the most part, you know, when somebody says, you know, I am a lesbian or I am gay, people can fit that into a box easier, right? Because you can, in your mind, you can kind of set parameters around that. But then when you take out harsher parameters, that's when you're in that real gray area. And that's where I think people get really uncomfortable because we've never really in a mainstream way kind of discussed that. And there's a lot of justifications of like, well, do you prefer to be with a man? Do you prefer to be with a woman? It's like, I don't prefer any, that's the point. I don't prefer anything. And that somehow, you know, you have to like, something has to happen almost to like make you be that way. Like, oh, I had a bad boyfriend, I'm going to just go be with women now and explore that and see what that's like. And it's like, no, I mean, maybe for some people, right, that might be how it starts for them. But I mean, for myself and all of my friends that I've ever talked to that are also pan or bi, it's been that way since birth, right? They don't know any other time that they've not been that way.
The last kind of point that I wanted to make here is kind of touch on like sex positive and like sex positivity and like that, as I guess like a movement, and something that I think our society needs to do, as well as, you know, the anti-rape movement needs to do to combat sexual violence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so having these conversations where we're able to be so honest and vulnerable about, yeah, our sexual desires, what we're into, I think is like a key part of that. And so I kind of wanted to hear, I don't know, maybe what sex positive meant for you and your journey.
Mm-hmm. I feel like up until like the last several years, I haven't been as publicly sex positive, because it was so ingrained in me that like, you don't talk about these things and, you know, it's a private matter. But then the more that I started getting into advocacy roles, I started understanding really the importance of creating normalcy around it. And especially through my trauma and my existing situation, like my current situation with the persecution of my childhood perpetrator, I started to understand really how important it is to be vocal about it. Because not only does it change the stigma over time, right? Like, be the seed, like plant the seeds that you want to see grow in the world, right? Like, be the positivity that you want to exist. But it also can help other individuals who are suffering from something, whether it be suffering from feeling like they have to hide themselves, right? or those that are suffering from abuse who don't understand that it's not normal. So for me, the sex positivity portion of it is so important for those two reasons. It's also to not only change the stigma in society, but to also help those who don't know that it's not normal. And it really hits home for me because, you know, the first person to really sit me down and tell me, hey, this isn't normal the way that your family treats you. Like, this isn't normal the things that you've experienced, was my boss, my very first true boss. And if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have had the fortunate situation to start to heal sooner than most people get to, I feel like. So I became a supervisor and went on to manage a group of people, mostly college-aged kids. And I say kids, but, you know, they're kids to me. Because I was so open about my situation with like my court battle and the way my family was, I actually had a student that started opening up to me about their situation. And they'd go like, oh, like my mom does that. Or like, oh, like my family does that. And I was able to do what I learned through my old boss of, hey, just planting those seeds of like, you know, that doesn't really seem healthy, or that doesn't really seem like something you appreciate, right? Because it's never, that's not normal, right? Because there is no normal. But it's also, you know, being able to say to those that do open up like, hey, you know, this isn't something that is healthy or seems like something you appreciate. And I was able to help an individual escape their extremely abusive family just by being open, and then them feeling like they could open up. And that was their first time somebody telling them, hey, that's, no one's told me that before. I've never thought about that as being abusive. I've never thought about that being controlling. And then getting them the right resources, right? So that really, really solidified that for me several years ago. And from then on, I was very adamant that as much as I could, without bringing harm to myself, right, I was going to be as open and as vocal and as vulnerable as I could, because not only is it helping change society, not only is it helping others, but it's also helping me heal through the ownership of it. And I think, you know, when you can, when you're comfortable, it's a privilege to be able to be sex positive. It's a privilege for a lot of people. And I'm sort of in that privileged area because I don't have a family that can shame me. I have an amazing partner who is incredibly supportive. I have a workspace that is incredibly supportive and positive. And I'm privileged to be in that scenario. Whereas, you know, if I was in a country that wasn't, or if I was in a job or had a family that I couldn't escape, right, couldn't get away from their suppression, you know, then I wouldn't have that opportunity. And so I feel like it's also, you know, you have that as a privilege. You should use that pedestal if you're able to be sex positive.
That was beautiful.
Oh, thank you.
I feel like more people need to hear that. I don't feel like we give survivors the power that they have, because it's people like you that are going to make the difference. You know what I mean? Like, those are things that when this podcast comes out, like, how many people can it touch? How many people that may be at Hope Harbor right now can see that, you know, maybe they're at the start of this type of journey to get their sense of self-discovery and their sense of clarity and things. And like, they need to hear that their voice, especially, you know, I like that you pointed out your privilege and like, you know, this is how I can make a difference. And that's a form of healing as well. Cause we always say things like, you know, we don't want you to use volunteering as a sense of healing, but sharing your story. I mean, that's the entire Me Too movement, is like putting yourself out there. This is never going to be, none of this is ever going to end until fingers are pointed at it and it's seen as a problem. And we take these stories out of the darkness.
Yeah. But I think there is definitely, you know, something to be said about, you know, the time and the place for it, right? Like, for example, you know, if I am in an advocacy situation through Hope Harbor and I am assisting a survivor through reporting. And a survivor asks me, which happens a lot, you know, have you experienced this? That can be an interesting conversation, because what you don't want to have happen is for it to turn into about you, right? It needs to be about them. And so what I will say is, yes, you know, I have experienced, you know, sexual assault in my past. And it's why this mission is very close to me. And I just divert the conversation back to them. You know, I divert it back to them. Now it's interesting because, you know, in my personal life, since I started volunteering with Hope Harbor, but even a little bit before, when I started on social media, being very vocal about my family situation and about my court battles and my abuse, I have had so many people come forward to me just on a personal basis. And in those scenarios, you know, I have had people get healing behind understanding, oh, they went through that too. And hearing my story and then me hearing their story, right? And so it absolutely can be a form of not just healing for the individual, but healing for that survivor as well, to not feel so alone. And I think you can kind of relate it back to the movement for, I don't even know which organization owns this, but for children who are gay, this It Gets Better, right? The It Gets Better movement. It really should be a part of the survivor movement, because it gets better, and you can heal, your life can get better. There are resources for you. You don't have to stay in your predicament, right? So I feel like it can also be a beacon of hope of, hey, you know, this individual has experienced extreme sexual abuse through childhood, through adulthood, in several forms of types of abuse, from physical, mental, emotional, to abuse through strangers, internet, right? Like all kinds of forms of it. Yet they can still overcome those things by taking advantage of the resources that they have available to them, right? So I think it's important to also show the other side of where you can end up. And I think it's interesting, because I originally didn't reach out to Hope Harbor because there was a blurb. I don't know if it was on the website or on a piece of paper or what, that said, you know, you can't be in therapy and you can't talk about being a survivor. And I was like, oh, well, that's not for me then. And so then I talked to somebody who worked there, and they were like, oh, no, you should think about volunteering. And I said, oh, well, I hadn't before because of that. And they're like, well, you know, like, as long as you, you know, have really come to a great emotional maturity place and you feel like you can handle it, then we'd love to have you, kind of thing. And I'm glad I did, because then I met Alina, and, you know, I interviewed with her, and it's been the best thing that's probably ever happened to me, is becoming an advocate. So, you know, I think it is important to also own that, but being mindful of when you disclose or talk about your personal experiences, because there's a time and a place for everything. Sure.
I don't think I knew that part.
Still have that blurb somewhere. That's problematic.
No, I bet when you looked at the website, it was like the old website that, like, we had no access to a change and stuff. So who knows when that was written. Yeah, like, hearing you say that, though, I think is so important, because that is something I've really challenged since being at Hope Harbor, was, why do we have this rule? So do you trust me to make that decision, you know, to know when this is? And then also, let's challenge why we don't want to hear people's stories.
Right.
You know, like, what is going on here? What is this true? Mm-hmm. What's the root problem? And I will say, and it's because whoever, like, these, there are quite a few of these types of policies that are not only in Hope Harbor, but across our state, that are basically rooted in not being trauma informed and rooted in the taboo, right, of being a survivor, while also, like, trying to empower people. Like, it honestly makes no sense. And so I would really love to see us to get back to being, you know, the anti-rape movement was a survivor created movement. It was survivor led, just like a lot of other movements, you know, substance abuse. You basically have to be you know, a, had to have, you know, been an addict or are an addict, right? To work in substance abuse. Like it's mm-hmm. like that just comes along with the territory, right? You know, mm-hmm. people always share that. You know, eating disorders is the same way. Our movement is not. And it's like this understood thing that, oh, if you talk about your assault, your trauma, you're not at a good place. Like this like very bizarre thing, while also encouraging people to go to therapy, but then punishing them for being in therapy. And that's really confusing and doesn't really make a lot of sense. And I think that shows where our movement has gone from being a movement to being a sector of nonprofit to where we just want to get grant money from mm-hmm. funders. And put people in therapy and not actually in sexual violence.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I feel like having policies that are around, we don't, it's not that it, I don't even know that it explicitly said you can't be a survivor, but it said something about like, you can't be in therapy. I remember it saying that it said something like, you know, you can't be in therapy. And I was told that I could have like a release note signed. Like if my therapist thought it was a good idea, which I never wound up doing because I felt like Elena and my interview went obviously really well because then I went on to do it. Right. But I feel like what it does cultivate is like a martyr sort of syndrome of like, well, you want to tell other people that they can be open and own what's happened and take, you know, control over it, empowerment, but for yourself, no, you can't show that vulnerable facade. And there are absolutely times and places for that. Absolutely. Right. Like I'm not going to disclose anything when I am focused on a survivor. Right. And that is my sole focus, the advocacy for that individual. But there are times where that can help heal a survivor who needs to hear it, because it's one of the things, especially like you brought up, like, you know, drug addicts and the recovery, you know, the complexity of that. As somebody who has been very close with a drug addict, and this really applies to everything in life, you're going to trust someone who's been through it more than someone who hasn't, right? And I think that's why we get asked so often. I mean, almost every time I have advocated or had long conversations on the crisis line, I almost always get asked, have you experienced this before? In a roundabout way, right? Somehow they wind up asking it. And I think it's because they just want to know I'm not alone and, you know, others have experienced it. And that's where it can end, right? It doesn't have to be a whole, oh yeah, well, let me sit down and run you through the laundry list of everything that I've been through, right? But I think it is an interesting subject because you need to be stoic for the individual, but you also need to be vulnerable as well if we're really going to be drinking our own Kool-Aid.
Was there anything else, Kaylee, that you wanted to share that we didn't get to?
No, I think it's been a really great discussion. And I really just hope that this helps others who maybe haven't, you know, talked with somebody who is poly or is bi or pan or just doesn't really identify with a label. And also just, you know, understands that everything isn't black and white. And, you know, you can be who you want, be your authentic self, and you will find somebody or somebody's people who love and accept you. And there truly are people out there, even if you feel like you haven't come to that yet. But yeah, all the feel good stuff. That's really it. Nothing else.
Thank you for hanging out with us. And remember, we're still not asking for it.
This podcast has been brought to you by Hope Harbor, a sexual trauma recovery center located in South Central Kentucky. Special thanks to Girl Tones for our intro. Listen to the rest of their song, Can't Pause, and others wherever you stream or buy music.